And from Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster, and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, we've got a couple of things on the go. First, New York Times food writer Mark Bittman is going to tell us what's wrong with what we eat. This is a TED Talks that was played a little bit back in 2007, still with a lot of relevance, and it's part of a theme that we're going to be developing over the next few weeks here on the Green Majority about sort of some of the ways in which business affects the way in which our lives. And some of the times when you just get a little bit frustrated and you think, man, it seems like everybody knows that there's a problem here, say it's about climate change or any other issue, but it just doesn't seem like things are happening. So we're going to be telling a little bit of a story over the next few weeks about some of the reasons why that might have to be. So this week there's sort of a read between the lines, a little bit of an aspect to that first feature where we're going to be talking about agribusiness, for instance. And then second of all, in the a little bit more of a direct chop at that theme, second half of the program, we're going to be speaking to Richard Lundgren. Richard Lundgren is with the Canadian Environmental Law Association. He's going to be talking to us about an issue that was instigated by a press release put out by Sierra Club of Canada, which is talking more about Bill C-38, which very much follows that same sort of theme, which is going to be Bill C-38, of course, has lots of destructive aspects to it for the environment, and one of which that Richard is going to be talking about today. Was the first victim of Bill C-38, which is the group forced to drop a court action against radioactive waste exports. So Richard Lundgren from the Canadian Environmental Law Association will be joining us in the second half. However, right now we are joined by Leah Mazzolini, who has your international headlines.
Thanks, Darren. The effects of last year's Fukushima nuclear meltdowns are now showing signs in nearby wildlife. According to a Japanese paper published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, some butterflies in the surrounding area are found to have what scientists call severe abnormalities. These mutations are apparent in their wing formations, as well as an increase of the number of legs and antennae in each butterfly. The study began 2 months after the power plant accident in March 2011. A crew of Japanese researchers sampled 144 adult pale grass blue butterflies from 10 locations in Japan, including the Fukushima area. The team concluded that the higher rate of mutation came from eating contaminated food, but also from mutations in their genetic code. The evidence from these scientists mirror previous studies, which show that birds and butterflies are effective tools when investigating the long-term impacts of radioactive materials in the environment. The European Union has made over rules on electronic waste, or e-waste, which aims to allow member states to fight the illegal export of waste more efficiently. The new mandate, known as the Waste Electronic Equipment Directive, came into play on Monday, August 13th, affecting how companies, retailers, recycling firms, and consumers handle their technological waste. The update includes a series of ambitious new e-waste recovery and recycling targets. They will also introduce stiff penalties for companies and member states. Each country will now be required to collect 45% of electronic equipment sold for approved recycling or disposal from 2016. It will rise to 65% of equipment sold or 85% of electronic waste produced in 2019. The United Union predicts that they will have a huge impact on the e-waste recycling sector, yielding five times the amount of equipment that is currently being collected. American government officials are now touting that they have managed to bring the U.S.'s carbon emissions to a 20-year low, all thanks to the rise in cheap natural gas consumption. The U.S. Energy Information Agency, a part of the Energy Department, says the U.S. total carbon emissions for the first 4 months of 2012 fell to about 1992 levels. However, climate scientists advised to use cautious optimism because the drop of levels was due to a slower economy and the demand for cheap fuel rather than greener policies and the use of renewable energy. Climate expert from the University of Colorado, Roger Pelkey Jr., warns that natural gas is not a long-term solution for the carbon problem. He adds that it's cleaner than coal, but it still emits some carbon. Also, fracking is known for possible environmental consequences. Its risks include groundwater contamination, migration of gases and fracking chemicals, the mishandling of waste, and the health effects associated with these risks. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We'll be obviously coming back to, as I said, Bill C-38. We'll be speaking with Richard Lundgren of the Canadian Environmental Law Association later in the program. However, we're going to take a quick music break and be right back to hear from New York Times food writer Mark Bittman, who's going to tell us what's wrong with what we eat. And we are back. This is Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. We're going to go now to New York Times writer, New York Times food writer, Mark Bittman, who's going to tell us what's wrong with what we eat.
I'm going to start with this picture of a beautiful cow. I'm not a vegetarian. This is the old Nixon line, right? But I still think that this, maybe this era's version of this. Now, that is only a little bit hyperbolic. And why do I say it? Because only once before has the fate of individual people and the fate of all of humanity been so intertwined. There was the bomb, and there's now. And where we go from here is going to determine not only the quality and the length of our individual lives, but whether if we could see the Earth a century from now, we'd recognize it. It's a Holocaust of a different kind, and hiding under our desks isn't going to help. Start with the notion that global warming is not only real, but dangerous. Since every scientist in the world now believes this, and even President Bush has seen the light or pretends to, we can take this as a given. Then hear this, please. After energy production, livestock is the second highest contributor to atmosphere-altering gases. Nearly one-fifth of all greenhouse gas is generated by livestock production, more than transportation. Now, you can make all the jokes you want about cow farts, but methane is 20 times more poisonous than CO2, and it's not just methane. Livestock is also one of the biggest culprits in land degradation, air and water pollution, water shortages, and loss of biodiversity. There's more. Like, half the antibiotics in this country are not administered to people, but to animals. But lists like this become kind of numbing. So let me just say this. If you're progressive, if you're driving a Prius, or you're shopping green, or you're looking for organic, you should probably be a semi-vegetarian. Now, I'm no more anti-cattle than I am anti-atom, but it's all in the way we use these things. There's another piece of the puzzle, which Ann Cooper talked about beautifully yesterday, and one you already know. There's no question, none, that so-called lifestyle diseases, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, some cancers, are diseases that are far more prevalent here than in anywhere in the rest of the world. And that's the direct result of eating a Western diet. Our demand for meat, dairy, and refined carbohydrates, the world consumes 1 billion cans or bottles of Coke a day. Our demand for these things, not our need, our want, drives us to consume way more calories than are good for us. And those calories are in foods that cause, not prevent, disease. Now, global warming was unforeseen. We didn't know that pollution did more than cause bad visibility. Maybe a few lung diseases here and there, but, you know, that's not such a big deal. The current health crisis, however, is a little more the work of the evil empire. We were assured that the more meat and dairy and poultry we ate, the healthier we'd be. No. Overconsumption of animals, and of course junk food, is the problem, along with our poultry consumption of plants. Now, there's no time to get into the benefits of eating plants here. But the evidence is that plants, and I want to make this clear, it's not the ingredients in plants, it's the plants. It's not the beta carotene, it's the carrot. The evidence is very clear that plants promote health. This evidence is overwhelming at this point. You eat more plants, you eat less other stuff, you live longer. Not bad. But back to animals and junk food. What do they have in common? One, we don't need either of them for health. We don't need animal products, and we certainly don't need white bread or Coke. Two, both have been marketed heavily, creating unnatural demand. We're not born craving Whoppers or Skittles. Three, their production has been supported by government agencies at the expense of a more health and earth-friendly diet. Now, let's imagine a parallel. Let's pretend that our government supported an oil-based economy while discouraging more sustainable forms of energy, knowing all the while that the result would be pollution, war, and rising costs. Incredible, isn't it? Yet they do that, and they do this here. It's the same deal. The sad thing is, when it comes to diet, is that even when well-intentioned feds try to do right by us, they fail. Either they're outvoted by puppets of agribusiness, or they are puppets of agribusiness. So when the USDA finally acknowledged that it was plants rather than animals that made people healthy, they encouraged us via their overly simplistic food pyramid to eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, along with more carbs. What they didn't tell us is that some carbs are better than others, and that plants and whole grains should be supplanting meat and junk food. But industry lobbyists would never let that happen. And guess what? Half the people who developed the food pyramid have ties to agribusiness. So instead of substituting plants for animals, our swollen appetites simply became larger, and the most dangerous aspects of them remained unchanged. So-called low-fat diets, so-called low-carb diets, these are not solutions. But with lots of intelligent people focusing on whether food is organic or local, or whether we're being nice to animals, the most important issues just aren't being addressed. Now, don't get me wrong. I like animals. And I don't think it's just fine to industrialize their production and to churn them out like they were wrenches. But there's no way to treat animals well when you're killing 10 billion of them a year. That's our number, 10 billion. If you strung all of them, chickens, cows, pigs, and lambs, to the moon, they'd go there and back 5 times, there and back. Now, my math's a little shaky, but this is pretty good. And it depends whether a pig is 4 feet long or 5 feet long, but you get the idea. That's just the United States. And with our hyperconsumption of those animals producing greenhouse gases and heart disease, kindness might just be a bit of a red herring. Let's get the numbers of the animals we're killing for eating down, and then we'll worry about being nice to the ones that are left. Another red herring might be exemplified by the word locavore, which was just named Word of the Year by the New Oxford American Dictionary. Seriously. A locavore, for those of you who don't know, is someone who eats only locally grown food, which is fine if you live in California, but for the rest of us, it's a bit of a sad joke. Between the official story, the food pyramid, and the hip locavore vision, you have 2 versions of how to improve our eating. They both get it wrong, though. The first, at least, is populist. The second is elitist. How we got to this place is the history of food in the United States. And I'm going to go through that, at least the last 100 years or so, very quickly right now. 100 years ago, guess what? Everyone was a locavore. Even New York had pig farms nearby, and shipping food all over the place was a ridiculous notion. Every family had a cook, usually a mom, and those moms bought and prepared food. It was like your romantic vision of Europe. Margarine didn't exist. In fact, when margarine was invented, several states passed laws declaring that it had to be dyed pink, so we'd all know that it was a fake. There was no snack food, and until the 20s, until Clarence Birdseye came along, there was no frozen food. There were no restaurant chains. There were neighborhood restaurants run by local people, but none of them would think to open another one. Eating ethnic was unheard of unless you were ethnic. And fancy food was entirely French. As an aside, those of you who remember Dan Aykroyd in 1970s doing Julia Child's imitations can see where he got the idea of stabbing himself from this fabulous slide. Back in those days, before even Julia, back in those days, there was no philosophy of food. You just ate. You didn't claim to be anything. There was no marketing. There were no national brands. Vitamins had not been invented. There were no health claims, at least not federally sanctioned ones. Fats, carbs, proteins, they weren't bad or good. They were food. You ate food. Hardly anything contained more than one ingredient because it was an ingredient. The cornflake hadn't been invented. The Pop-Tart, the Pringle, Cheese Whiz, none of that stuff. Goldfish swam. It's hard to imagine. People grew food and they ate food. And again, everyone ate local. In New York, an orange was a common Christmas present because it came all the way from Florida. From the 30s on, road systems expanded, trucks took the place of railroads, fresh food began to travel more, oranges became common in New York. The South and West became agricultural hubs, and in other parts of the country, suburbs took over farmland. The effects of this are well known, they're everywhere, and the death of family farms is part of this puzzle, as is almost everything, from the demise of the real community to the challenge of finding a good tomato even in summer. Eventually, California produced too much food to ship fresh, so it became critical to market canned and frozen food. Convenience. It was sold to proto-feminist housewives as a way to cut down on housework. Now, I know everybody over the age of like 45's mouths are watering at this point. And if we had a slide of Salisbury steak, even more so, right? But this may have cut down on housework, but it cut down on the variety of food we ate as well. Many of us grew up never eating a fresh vegetable, except the occasional raw carrot or maybe an lettuce salad. I, for one, and I'm not kidding, didn't eat real spinach or broccoli till I was 19. Who needed it, though? Meat was everywhere. What could be easier? Already raised unnaturally. Rather than spending their lives eating grass, for which their stomachs were designed, they were forced to eat soy and corn. They have trouble digesting those grains, of course, but that wasn't a problem for producers. New drugs kept them healthy. Well, they kept them alive. Healthy was another story. Thanks to farm subsidies, a fine collaboration between agribusiness and Congress, soy, corn, and cattle became king, and chicken soon joined them on the throne. It was during this period that the cycle of dietary and planetary destruction began, the thing we're only realizing just now. Listen to this. Between 1950 and 2000, the world's population doubled. Meat consumption increased fivefold. Now, someone had to eat all that stuff, so we got fast food. And this took care of the situation resoundingly. Home cooking remained the norm, but its quality was down the tubes. There were fewer meals with home-cooked breads, desserts, and soups, because all of them could be bought at any store. Not that they were any good, but they were there. Most moms cooked like mine, a piece of broiled meat, a quickly made salad with bottled dressing, canned soup, canned fruit salad, maybe baked or mashed potatoes, or, perhaps the stupidest food ever, minute rice. For dessert, store-bought ice cream or cookies. My mom is not here, so I can say this now. This kind of cooking drove me to to learn how to cook for myself. It wasn't all bad. By the 70s, forward-thinking people began to recognize the value of local ingredients. We tended gardens, we became interested in organic food, we knew or we were vegetarians. We weren't all hippies either. Some of us were eating in good restaurants and learning how to cook well. Meanwhile, food production had become industrial. Industrial. Perhaps because it was being produced rationally, as if it were plastic. Food gained magical or poisonous powers, or both. Many people became fat-phobic. Others worshipped broccoli as if it were godlike. But mostly they didn't eat broccoli. Instead, they were sold on yogurt, yogurt being almost as good as broccoli. Except in reality, the way the industry sold yogurt was to convert it to something much more akin to ice cream. Similarly, let's look at a granola bar. You think that that might be healthy food, but in fact, if you look at the ingredient list, it's closer in form to a Snickers than it is to oatmeal. Sadly, it was at this time that the family dinner was put in a coma, if not actually killed. Beginning of the heyday of value-added food, which contained as many soy and corn products as could be crammed into it. Think of the frozen chicken nugget. The chicken is fed corn, and then its meat is ground up and mixed with more corn products to add bulk and binder, and then it's fried in corn oil. All you do is nuke it. What could be better? And sad, horribly, pathetically, by the 70s, home cooking was in such a sad state that the high fat and spice contents of foods like McNuggets and Hot Pockets, and we all have our favorites actually, made this stuff more appealing than the bland things that people were serving at home. At the same time, masses of women were entering the workforce, and cooking simply wasn't important enough for men to share the burden. So now, you got your pizza nights, you got your microwave nights, you got your grazing nights, you got your fend for yourself nights, and so on. Leading the way, what's leading the way? Meat, junk food, cheese, the very stuff that will kill you. So now we clamor for organic food. That's good. And as evidence that things can actually change, you can now find organic food in supermarkets and even in fast food outlets. But organic food isn't the answer either, at least not the way it's currently defined. Let me pose you a question. Can farm-raised salmon be organic when its feed has nothing to do with its natural diet, even if the feed itself is supposedly organic, and the fish themselves are packed tightly in pens, swimming in their own filth? And if that salmon's from Chile, and it's killed down there, and then flown 5,000 miles, whatever, dumping how much carbon into the atmosphere? I don't know. Packed in styrofoam, of course, before landing somewhere in the United States, and then being trucked a few hundred more miles. This may be organic in letter, but it's surely not organic in spirit. Now here's where we all meet. The locavores, the organivores, the vegetarians, the vegans, the gourmets, and those of us who are just plain interested in good food. Even though we've come to this from different points, we all have to act on our knowledge to change the way that everyone thinks about food. We need to start acting, and this is not only an issue of social justice, as Ann Cooper said, though of course she's completely right, but it's also one of global survival. Which brings me full circle and points directly to the core issue, the overproduction and overconsumption of meat and junk food. As I said, 18% of greenhouse gases are attributed to livestock production. How much livestock do you need to produce this? 70% of the agricultural land on Earth, 30% of the Earth's land surface is directly or indirectly devoted to raising the animals we'll eat. And this amount is predicted to double in the next 40 years or so. And if the numbers coming in from China are anything like what they look like now, it's not going to be 40 years. There is no good reason for eating as much meat as we do, and I say this as a man who has eaten a fair share of corned beef in his life. The most common argument is that we need nutrients. Even though we eat, on average, twice as much protein as even the industry-obsessed USDA recommends. But listen, experts who are serious about disease reduction recommend that adults eat just over half a pound of meat per week. What do you think we eat per day? Half a pound. But don't we need meat to be big and strong? Isn't meat eating essential to health? Won't a diet heavy in fruit and vegetables turn us into godless sissy liberals? Some of us might think that would be a good thing. But no. Even if we were all steroid-filled football players, the answer is no. In fact, there's no diet on earth that meets basic nutritional needs that won't promote growth. And many will make you much healthier than ours does. We don't eat animal products for sufficient nutrition. We eat them to have an odd form of malnutrition, and it's killing us. To suggest that in the interest of personal and human health, Americans eat 50% less meat, it's not enough of a cut, but it's a start. It would seem absurd, but that's exactly what should happen. And what progressive people, forward-thinking people, should be doing and advocating, along with a corresponding increase in the consumption of plants. I've been writing about food more or less omnivorously, one might say indiscriminately, for about 30 years. During that time, I've eaten and recommended eating just about everything. I'll never stop eating animals, I'm sure. But I do think that for the benefit of everyone, the time has come to stop raising them industrially and stop eating them thoughtlessly. Ann Cooper's right. The USDA is not our ally here. We have to take matters into our own hands, not only by advocating for a better diet for everyone, that's the hard part, but by improving our own. And that happens to be quite easy. Less meat, less junk, more plants. It's a simple formula. Eat food. Eat real food. We can continue to enjoy our food, and we continue to eat well, and we can eat even better. We can continue to search for the ingredients we love, and we can continue to spin yarns about our favorite meals. We'll reduce not only calories, but our carbon footprint. We can make food more important, not less, and save ourselves by doing so. We have to choose that path. Thank you.
All right, and we were back. That was what we should and should not eat. We're going to go now to our national headlines. However, we're joined once again by Leah Mazzolini.
Thanks, Darren. A recent survey by Insightrix Research, a Regina-based carbon capture and storage study center, revealed that 2% of Canadian respondents do not believe in climate change. The report released on Wednesday, August 15th, polled over 1,500 people online between May 29th and June 11th of this year. Insightrix CEO Carmen Dybwad said that response revealed the overwhelming majority of Canadians feel climate change is real. Additionally, the report revealed that 32% of Canadians believe climate change is the result of human activity, but 54% said it was a combination of natural climate variation and human activity. According to the poll, residents of British Columbia, Quebec, and Atlantic provinces were most likely to feel climate change is because of human activity. Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson announced the city has added 13 new electric cars, making it a total fleet of 16 on Wednesday, August 15th. The city paid approximately $30,000 for each vehicle, according to Peter Judd, the city's general manager of energy or engineering services. The city hoped the green vehicles will reduce the city's greenhouse gas emissions by 29,000 kilograms. Mayor Robertson also says they could save the city over $20,000 in fuel and maintenance costs annually. Vancouver is planning to increase the vehicle-friendly infrastructure by creating 67 charging stations in addition to its current six. Recharging can take between 30 minutes and 22 hours. Critics note a possible roadblock in that vehicles can only last up to 155 kilometers without needing a boost. But Mayor Robertson was confident that the distances driven in Vancouver tend to be short. And that's all for the national news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We're going to be back in just a minute or two with Richard Lundgren from the Canadian Environment Law Association to talk about, among other things, the first victim of Harper's Bill C-38. However, we're going to take a quick music break and we'll be right back. Stay tuned. right. We're back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I believe I have Richard Lindgren from the Canadian Environment Law Association on the line. Are you there, Richard?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. This is an ongoing major issue. We've been covering it recently on The Green Majority, and we're great to have someone from the CELA join us today to maybe break it down in a little bit more detail. The piece that caught my eye that made me decide to do another feature on it today was, of course, the Sierra Club Canada release about the Bill C-38's first victim. But why don't we start a little bit before we jump into right what the current events is, if we could just maybe do an overview about exactly what is Bill C-38 and why should people who are interested in the environment be concerned?
Well, Bill C-38 is the federal budget bill that was passed by the Harper government a number of weeks ago. It's a massive bill. It's hundreds and hundreds of pages. But one of the things it does is roll back a number of federal environmental protection laws, including the Fisheries Act, the Species at Risk Act, and perhaps most importantly, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act. And in short, what Bill C-38 did was repeal the old environmental assessment law that we've had here in Canada for about the last 20 years, and it's worked pretty well, and basically replace it with a new regime that, which is far narrower and not very comprehensive and not very credible. So it's a significant step backwards.
So, I mean, one of the things that we might say as well, of course, environmentalists, of course, always have something to complain about, I guess, to a certain degree. So, I mean, I would say that to a point, environmentalists, you know, weren't entirely, let's say, perfectly happy. I think everyone would have agreed there was, even with the existing laws that have now been either streamlined or completely cut out, that there was room for improvement there. So the environmental community, well, maybe some of these rules that have just recently been removed, would say some of them weren't bad, maybe, and some of them were good, you know, well thought out laws. They certainly, if anything needed to be done, they could have been improved. So what I'm wondering is, what at least from your point of view, what was the government's reason for at least on the part that's affected by the environment, specifically having to do with the Review Act? What was their reason for why that this needed to be removed? Is this a money saving? Did they think they were ineffective? What was their excuse?
Well, let's call a spade in my view. The only rationale was to speed up approvals of major projects like oil pipelines and tar sands developments and the Northern Gateway project, etc. You know, I think the people who now have the reins of power in Ottawa perceive environmental assessment as just mere red tape that's standing in the way of jobs and economic growth and so forth. So to their mind, the best way to, you know, get around it is to repeal it and put in place, you know, a much more narrow set of rules that really don't protect the environment or safeguard the public interest.
So in your opinion, was there any real attempt to sort of justify it at all, or did they just really kind of go, yeah, all right, this is what's going on now, too bad?
Well, here's what's puzzling. The Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, as I mentioned, has been in force since the mid-1990s. And it's been periodically reviewed by the Standing Committee on Environment and Sustainable Development. And a number of incremental reforms have been reviewed, and some of them have actually even been implemented. And even a few months ago, the most recent review was conducted. In fact, I went to Ottawa and spoke to the Standing Committee. And I think there was a consensus that there was room for improvement. There were things that could be fixed to make it more timely, more predictable, and so forth. And so a number of parties had identified some changes that should be brought forward, and the Standing Committee considered some of these changes and issued a report which adopted some changes but not others. But nowhere in the Standing Committee's report did it call for the wholesale repeal or abolition of the existing law. Nevertheless, mere weeks after the release of the report, that's exactly what the Harper government did.
Okay, and so I mean the theme here. Before we just jump right into what this most recent, as the press release says, the first victim, as it were. Before we just jump right into the details of that, specifically, I mean, there seems to be the theme here, which is, I mean, I'm very, very adverse to getting into anything that feels like any sort of conspiracy theory. I'm not interested in wild conspiracies or anything like that. But it's really hard as a rational thinking person who reads the news on a regular basis to not see this as just an outright blatant, no, they're not even trying to hide it, attack on public input and by extension democracy in Canada. I mean, it feels like an extreme thing to say, but I'm really having a lot of trouble seeing any other way to look at it.
Well, you know, I tend to share that view because these very, very significant changes were buried in a budget bill. I mean, if you want to have an open, democratic, you know, fulsome debate on environmental assessment, you know, introduce a standalone bill and, you know, let's have that the argument. Let's have a proper parliamentary process so these the pros and cons of the proposed changes can be fully assessed and identified, and then we move forward. But that's not what happened here. Budget bills, particularly those produced by a majority government, tend to get, short shrift. They get expedited through the process, and there's not much time or room for debate. So these are very, very significant changes, and I see them as nothing less than an attack on Canadian core values and Canadian democracy as we know it.
All right. So getting right into the specific issue here, we're talking about our first victim. This is with reference to shipping nuclear waste through the Great Lakes system. Do you want to talk a little bit about just exactly what this court case that yourself, the Sierra Club and the Hadjibu withdrawal having to do with this? They lost. What exactly happened? That the KCOS was lost, or it was withdrawn, or what actually was the event?
Okay, well, just to back up a step, you'll probably recall that a couple of years ago, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission issued two permits to Bruce Power to allow Bruce Power to take these radioactive steam generators that were decommissioned at the Bruce Station as part of the refurbishment, and the permits purported to allow Bruce Power to take these decommissioned steam generators out of storage, move them down the road to Owen Sound, put them on a vessel, have the vessel go through the lower Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway over to Sweden. The idea was that these contaminated metals would be melted down. The less contaminated metals would be recovered and perhaps melted into ingots and sold on the world metal market. And then the contaminated residue would be shipped back to Canada and back up to the Bruce site for permanent storage. So that's what the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission approved in the two permits, the transport and the export of this radioactive material. The problem is that no environmental assessment was conducted prior to the issuance of the permits, and that's what prompted Sierra Club Canada and the Canadian Environmental Law Association to go to court. So basically we're asking the federal court to strike down the permits on the grounds that the required environmental assessment was not conducted.
And then now, because of Bill C-38, there's basically no opportunity to, there's basically no recourse on this. Am I reading that wrong?
Well, you see, what happened was we were asking the court to enforce the old Canadian Environmental Assessment Act. There are certain provisions in it that we were relying upon to make the argument that there should have been an environmental assessment of this very significant activity. The problem is Bill C-38 repealed that law in its entirety, so there was nothing left for the court to decide, or nothing left for the court to interpret. And in the meantime, the permits expired anyways. They were only good for a year, and they expired. About 2 days ago, we filed notices of discontinuance with the federal court. The whole thing has been rendered moot by the passage of the new law, which definitely does not apply to this kind of activity.
Okay, so and let's be clear about exactly what it is that we're talking about. When you're saying there was no environmental assessment performed, I mean, should that be taken literally? Was there literally no, at any point, consideration taken for possible environmental damage, or is this just that like some official process wasn't found, but there was research done? Like, how much consideration of the environment was taken at all in this case?
Okay, prior to the issuance of the two permits, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission conducted a two-day public hearing because there are a number of groups and individuals, First Nations, municipalities, others who are quite concerned about this prospect. So a two-day hearing was convened in Ottawa, and people brought forward their, factual and technical and scientific concerns about environmental risks and health risks, et cetera. Of course, all of the interveners who participated in that hearing were limited to 10 minutes each, so it's hard to really explain all the concerns on this highly complex matter in about 10 minutes. But in any event, the commission listened to the evidence and then issued the permit anyways. That was the transport permit. The export permit was actually issued behind closed doors. There was no hearing whatsoever. And so that's a concern that our groups had. There is a permitting process that the commission carries out. If you were talking to a commission representative, they would tell you, well, of course we take environmental considerations into account, but it's not an environmental assessment process. It's a permitting process. And that's why we went to court to say, commission, if you think that this is such a good idea and if you fully identify and mitigate the environmental risk, then prove it in an environmental assessment process. That's why we have one. But That never happened.
So, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of, when you're talking about policy and bills and all these sorts of things, like people that aren't necessarily academic on the subject, I'm certainly only, you know, sort of tangentially educated on how all this sort of stuff works. I mean, there's a lot of language that gets thrown around, and I think the issue can easily become very confusing. But I mean, am I misreading the situation to almost say that, I mean, the industry, in this case, Bruce Power and the powers that be, that, you know, people that stand to that want this project to go through, essentially they've had an opportunity to have hearings for months. I mean, they essentially are able to lobby the government. They work on these plans. They go through all the details. So it's not a matter of, you know, the pros and cons are all issued in these meetings and everyone gets 10 minutes. Am I wrong to sort of put it in the context that, you know, the people that want the projects like this to go through essentially get months and months and months of the government's time to say why they should do it, and then you get sort of 5 minutes to respond at the end? Is that a wrong way to read this?
No, that's a fair assessment. There's lots of ongoing dialogue between commission staff and representatives of the proponent that go on behind closed doors. So again, it's a question of accessibility, and it's a question of, you know, meaningful public participation. You know, we want a meaningful say. In my view, we didn't get it in the limited commission process that we had on the one permit, and that's another reason why we thought we need environmental assessment. Environmental assessment is all about ensuring that interested folks, interested groups, and individuals have a meaningful opportunity to get into the decision-making process and influence the outcome. And that's why we went to court, to try to make sure that an environmental assessment was conducted in this case.
And I mean, that seems to sort of almost be an admitted point that the government, in a general sense, understands that this sort of issue can't possibly be reasonably or rationally decided on any issue within this particular case or any other case in a 10-minute presentation, because of the simple fact that they do give access to the pro side, if you will, for months and months. They seem to understand that it takes months and months to really work out all the details. So there seems to almost be an implied admission that they know that there's really no, say, you know, rational case that can be built in the amount of time that they give the public to put in their two cents on these issues.
Well, you know, I keep thinking about my experiences in court, you know, when we're prosecuting polluters or if we're seeking compensation for victims of pollution. Courts don't impose time limits like that. I mean, you need the time to properly present a fulsome case and respond to the case being put forward to the other side. So we don't get 10-minute limits in court. And that being the case, why would we, you know, stand by and idly accept 10-minute limits imposed by a regulatory agency on matters of profound public interest? It just makes no sense to me.
Well, and I think as well, if you flip it the other way around, we could say, well, maybe it would be fair if Bruce Power only got 10 minutes of the government's time, but the government would freely admit that they would have no way of possibly making a decision with only 10 minutes of Bruce Power's time.
I would certainly support that initiative, but I don't see it happening.
Okay, so where do we go from here? I mean, is this game over and there's nothing we can do here? Or, I mean, where do we go forward with working within the now enacted Bill C-38?
Okay, well, I can think of two things. Number one, as I mentioned earlier, the permits in question have both expired, so really the ball's in Bruce Power's court. And if they want to resurrect this export plan, then they have to reapply for permits. So we all need to be very watchful. We have to, you know, closely scrutinize what Bruce Power is applying for and what they're proposing to do, and again, make all kinds of kicking and screaming noises at the commission when this lands there. That's the first thing to do. But stepping back, as I mentioned earlier, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, the new version that just got introduced by the Tories, does not apply to this activity. And the reason I say that is that there's a new regulation under the Act that specifies the small list of major projects that will trigger an environmental assessment moving forward. So things like big mines and oil and gas and, you know, pipelines, that will trigger environmental assessment. But the physical act of shipping or exporting large amounts of radioactive waste, it's not on the projects list. And so I think it behooves all of us who are concerned about that to start lobbying the government to make sure that the regulation is amended to include this kind of activity. And ironically enough, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency, which is the federal agency which administers the EA law, is now actually soliciting public comment on potential additions to the list. And that public comment period actually ends next Friday on August 24th. So if you or your listeners have some concerns about the exclusion of hazardous waste, or sorry, radioactive waste shipments, then the time is now to tell the agency, yes, the list should be amended to include this kind of activity.
And is there somewhere that either the Canadian Environmental Law Association or Sierra Club of Canada have more resources where that people can go to look up information on here, or perhaps sign a letter or something like that that's for more information?
Probably the best place to go is a website called EnviroLawsMatter, all one word, .ca. And that's a collection of materials on the recent environmental assessment reforms and outlines the concerns that we all have and the amendments to the regulations that need to be implemented. So that's probably a good starting point. We, of course, at the Canadian Environmental Law Association have also written and lobbied extensively on this issue. So if you go to CELA.ca, I'm sure you'll find some more material. And if that doesn't work, track me down.
Absolutely. And so just closing up here, we've only got a minute or two left. I just wanted to ask you, if just kind of going forward now, I mean, we've got the Bruce Power issue is one issue that people should be very interested in about, especially when we're talking about Great Lakes and radioactivity sound is something that's very important. But in a more broad sense, of course, you have both UN's Canadian Environmental Law Association and Sierra Club of Canada. This is one of many, many issues that they're tracking. Is there anything else, any other cases, for instance, that are either in court right now or you're looking to have heard by a court coming up that you feel may also be affected by this, that people should be concerned about?
Well, there's a number of things in play if we're just confining ourselves to the nuclear front. First of all, we have another court case underway challenging the proposal to build new reactors at Darlington. So we've got a federal court case that's trying to set aside the environmental assessment that was conducted in relation to that proposal. At the same time, the Ontario Power Generation is proposing to extend the life of the existing reactors at Darlington. So that's now triggered another federal environmental assessment. So that's underway, and people can get involved in that. And the final thing I should probably mention is the ongoing federal environmental assessment for the Deep Geological Repository, which is being proposed next door to the Bruce Nuclear Site. And the idea is they want to build a series of underground caverns on the Lake Huron shore to basically store low and intermediate waste, radioactive waste, for literally hundreds of thousands of years. So there's no shortage of work to do.
And that's just confining ourselves to the nuclear issues, regardless of the other 47,000 other issues that we could possibly talk about today.
Exactly.
We might need a 400-hour long show to deal with those, so maybe we'll have you back on the program another time to get into some of that stuff. For now, I believe you said the website on this specific issue and or similar issues was EnviroLawsMatter.ca, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and of course, anyone who's interested can look up the Sierra Club of Canada or the Canadian Environmental Law Association for more information. Richard Lundgren, thank you so much for joining us on the Green Majority today.
Well, thank you, Darren. My pleasure.
All right, so we've got a few minutes left in the program. At the beginning, as I was sort of alluding to, we're sort of going to be developing a theme over the next few weeks. I've got sort of an itch in my back here that needs to be scratched, so I'm going to go take out my soapbox a little bit here for a couple of minutes. I've got Ryan Knight on the mic. Oh, Ryan, do you want to turn your mic up a little bit? We can't quite hear you enough there.
Oh, is that better?
That's a little better, maybe a little higher.
Better?
There, now we go. We can hear you. So, Ryan, I've had a little bit of an itch that needs scratching here, and so I'm going to take out my soapbox here for a couple of minutes. The theme that I was sort of alluding to at the beginning of the program was one of, well, we sort of had it in both things. At the beginning, the guy who was talking about what we should eat was talking about agribusiness and how when things like the food tables, like those pyramids about three servings of milk and whatnot should be done.
Oh, that, like showing your daily intake.
Yeah, that he was talking about how big business had such a, especially specifically the meat industry had such a big influence on designing that. They didn't come up with it. It wasn't their own kind of marketing technique, but they did have a lot of influence into what it said because they wanted to protect their shares.
Right.
And so obviously now we also have we're just talking with Richard Lindgren, of course, where basically Bill C-38 removes a lot of the public participation from a lot of these conversations. So the theme that we're sort of drawing here is to put it in a really stark term is the word corruption, which is the scary C word, although I do prefer it to conspiracy because
I thought you were going
to
go conspiracy C word.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Corruption? I really don't like the word conspiracy, and conspiracy is sort of the thing that you say when you don't really have any evidence. I think there's a lot of evidence in this case, so we're going to go with corruption. And one of the themes, and it's there's a show I'd like to, it's the largest online TV show in the world, and I watch it faithfully, which is The Young Turks. And The Young Turks and Cenk Uygur on The Young Turks, you can look that up on YouTube. They mostly cover in American news, but they occasionally occasionally cover environment stuff and global issues as well. And he sort of went on this rant recently that really spoke to me, and that was sort of the inspiration for this sort of theme that we're going to draw out for the next few shows here, which is it's a matter of influence to our government. Because as we were just talking about with Richard Lindgren, in this specific case, the Bruce Power gets basically unlimited access to lobby the government for these issues, and then the system is set up such that the public gets, you know, a couple of hours, 10 minutes each to try and explain these super complex issues. In the other case, with the other one in the first feature, they were talking about the food pyramids and how, you know, an industry that is benefited by it was able to influence information that was then passed on to individuals with the seal of approval of, you know, a government agency on it saying, this is what you need to be doing, when it was to an extent specifically designed to help encourage one business or another.
Yeah, and that's crazy.
So, and this is the sort of thing that we're talking about with corruption. And the point that Jen Kuger here, I'm just checking my time before I go on too long a rant.
You're good.
Was that there's this idea here of corporations and people talk a lot of, and you're kind of touching on the Occupy movement and all that sort of thing with regards to banking, but it's even bigger than that, because there's so much influence that gets done, and people like you know, will go into, specifically it's more obvious in the U.S., but I think it definitely happens in Canada as well, where people will go and work in agencies and they'll come out, they'll get hired by, say, the Nuclear Commission because they used to run a power plant. Well, as soon as they're done working for the Nuclear Commission, they go back and work for the nuclear lobby agency or something like that. So basically, you're in a situation where all the people who are regulating these industries are coming from that industry.
Oh,
and go back to it afterwards.
That's brutal.
And so what you have is this massive incentive to sell out the public, because you know you're going to get a massive paycheck when you leave afterwards. And a lot of the times, the crazy thing is, a lot of the times that this is actually completely legal, because they've found ways to do it that skirt these kind of laws. Like, for instance, maybe they'll only give them the you know, $500 donation to their campaign during the campaign, but as soon as they've served out their term,
then they get the
kickbacks. Then you get a $7 million, you know, speaking tour contract that really was just being paid off for all the work that you've already done.
Ooh, sign me up.
Yeah, well, that could be one way to look at it. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's the main crux of the issue here, and it's sort of the thing that I'm trying to tie together over the next few weeks here, is that the main issue here is that, you know, and don't take me wrong, I'm not about to go on some rant about how we should be a communist country or anything like that.
Oh, I think, you know, we love your rants.
Capitalism is fantastic, but it's broken, and to a very demonstrable way. I think all our lives are run in a lot of ways by corporations and subjective advertising, and a lot of the information that gets passed on to us, specifically through our governments, is influenced by, and sometimes outright written by, simply stamped by the desk of the government and passed on to us, things that have been written by corporations. And the theme here that I want to draw is pointing out examples of ways when really, if you want to put it really into one, crystallize the issue into one thing, it's a matter of corruption and influence on people who make decisions, because there are so many reasons and examples of why people who are at a position of making decisions are in this culture of corruption, where there's so much corruption that you don't see, well, you know, someone else, if I'm not the guy that sells out all my friends for a couple of bucks, the guy behind me is going to do it anyway, so I might as well be the one to get the paycheck, because somebody's going to get it.
So is this almost like an attack on the culture of it, or they attack on
it's a culture of happening? There's a culture of corruption, a lot of that comes from corporations, which are, in a lot of sense, they're able to regulate themselves. They have far more money and influence and power than any individual government is concerned, and especially when you get a whole bunch of multinational corporations together, you know, things like there's a letter put out recently saying, well, if you buy 232 senators or something like that, you can basically get anything you want passed, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. And the thing is, it really doesn't take that much to buy out a senator, because all you do is you help them get reelected, and then as soon as they're done, you offer them a job.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
And so they're actually doing work for you. So it's not like you're even just handing off things. You're just saying, I'm going to give you the job rather than this guy because you helped me out. And it's just this entire nasty, corrupt system. And so we're talking a little bit, I mean, it applies in really finite terms to like agribusiness and all this stuff with the nuclear power issue. But really, when it comes down to it, there is just corruption. And I think understanding that, well, that it seems very fatalistic, understanding that, I think, makes sense. Because a lot of time I'll get frustrated, and we've talked about this before, is where we'll get frustrated and be like, man, it seems like everybody knows about this. I mean, that's why we call it the green majority, is it seems like everybody is aware that this is bad. True. It seems like a lot of people are aware of it. Most people are convinced that it's bad. Why does it never seem like anything happens? And my answer to that is, this is the reason why. There's people who are being paid not to care and to being paid not to represent your interests. Mm-hmm. And that seems, well, you know, that seems like a conspiracy. No, because a lot of it's legal. This isn't, you know, these are things that you can track. You can track that someone went from X Senate seat to X, you know, being the executive of X company, and it happens all the time.
And so that's like the whole culture that's just brewed together, and now it's too big to even like battle. Like,
absolutely. And it can become very difficult. I mean, look at all the, with the stock market, the company names are escaping me here for a minute, but a lot of the, like the big banks that, like Goldman Sachs and stuff like that, who were, they caught red-handed with internal letters saying, we have bad deals that we know are going to screw over our customers, and our top priority is to sell them to our customers. And not one of them went to jail. Not one. I mean, and you know, and you'll go spend some jail time for running a red light, and you know, and perhaps having a beer, which is terrible, and you should go to jail for that. But then,
pulled over for,
you know, this guy over, you know, over here can steal trillions of dollars from the public, and you know, they're like, well, you know, we didn't have enough evidence.
Well, they always say it's better to do white collar crime, because the payoff between, I guess, compared to the punishment is like, yeah, I'll do 2 years, but I embezzled millions of dollars, so after the 2 years, I'm still living pretty.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a famous quote by Donald Trump, actually, who said, the secret to success, because he's, you know, he's very, very wealthy and very famous.
Right.
He's been bankrupt, I believe, like 4 or 5 times. He said, you know, if you owe the bank $100,000, they own you. But if you owe the bank $100 million, you own them. Because they need their money back, and they're going to do everything they can to do it, help you. And that's how he went from millions of dollars to bankrupt to millions of dollars to bankrupt to millions of dollars to bankrupt, is he just kept borrowing, and to the point that he basically, the banks had to help him out.
Right.
You know, anyway, that seems that's to have eaten up a good 10-minute rant there. Maybe we'll cut that out as separate, but just to give you a little bit of a heads up of the sort of theme we're going to be running over the next few minutes. However, we are out of time. So today I want to thank you, Ryan Knight, very much for your technical production. Web hosting and bandwidth was provided by a podcast for a web consulting firm, rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or transcript of our news headlines, as always, at greenmajority.ca. If you have an idea or an issue for a topic you care about, we'd love to learn more about, perhaps you know a stupendous environmental thinker that Canadians should hear from, drop us a line at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We love hearing from our listeners. That is, however, all we have time for today. I'm Darren Kaster, and that's it for today's live edition of The Green Majority. Until next week, thanks for listening.